How y'all determining who used AI?
I mean, the biggest indicator is them dashes.
Yep.
I think we should be using AI to make our life easier and simpler. The thing is, like, right, like if you use AI to just tell straight out lies, it's like, why is that beneficial to anyone? You're going to end up making yourself look stupid. I could care less about a resume. Like, I'm all about that LinkedIn. It's almost like checking somebody's Instagram. Like, if the Instagram look a little weird, then I'm going to have my doubts about how you actually operate in real life. So I need your LinkedIn to be a good representation of how I feel like you come across as like a professional.
Welcome back to the Textual Talk Podcast. I'm your host, HD. And if you're still on the video right now, hit the like button. You don't got to subscribe yet. Keep watching. You'll probably subscribe later. And if you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you frequent podcast listenership, please follow us and leave us a comment or a review. Now, today's guest has been on the show. I think we were talking earlier. We don't know if it's 2 or 3 years ago at this point. I mean, we just live in here. But it's none other than Mr. Nate Wiley, a.k.a. Is it Infinite or Infinite?
Infinite.
Infinite Talent. And he definitely is going to come kick some game to you today about what recruiters look for when they look at your resume, why y'all have been spamming AI and it's really hurting your job's chances, and much, much more. So, Nate, man, thank you for pulling up on me today, man.
Nah, I appreciate it. Thanks for the invite back. You done leveled up. I think it was just a Zoom call or Google Meet, whatever it was last time.
Yeah, I think it was Riverside. That's what I started off on, Riverside.
And okay.
I was like, you know what? I'm ready to go ahead and go forward. So, like, before, I think I've been recording here since late October, I think. Because before that, the address that you sent, that's to the studio downtown.
Mm.
So I used to go downtown and record, which I didn't mind, but it used to start becoming a little track because I stay.
That's why I confirmed. I was like, well, you're a little piece down there.
Yeah,
I'm staying up in Plano. So I was like, okay.
I changed it. It should have said, with the address I sent you, it should have said that in the thing. So I had to double back and change it. Because honestly, I haven't had a lot of people that have came up here to record outside of people who's just already in the area. So
I appreciate it, man. Happy to be back.
Yeah, man. So for the people who didn't see that last episode, just a brief intro about yourself.
All right. So Nate Wiley, as you mentioned, recruiting sort of subject matter expert, if I can call myself that. But just actually, December makes 15 years in recruiting. So I started out staffing, moved in-house. So I done worked in like finance and worked in manufacturing and worked in distribution and worked in big tech. Now I primarily focus on startups, doing consulting. So consulting can be, you know, retainer fractional gigs. It can be contingent searches. It can be project-based work. But at the end of the day, most time I'm working with founders to try to find, you know, some of that niche talent, usually like bootstrap, Series A type startups.
Great. We'll definitely talk about that. I want to talk about, like, so you got 14 years of TA experience. Talk about a little bit about, I remember we talked about, I think we got like your first start when you was, I think you was at one of those contractor joints where y'all was having to get people last for the social.
Yeah, staffing.
Yeah.
Hopefully they still don't have to do that, but man, I wouldn't be surprised. They do?
They be asking people for like they last for, pictures of their ID and stuff now, all type of stuff.
I say that, but I imagine it has gotten worse because even applicants are kind of fake now. So the whole point of doing that was really just because these at the time I was sort of contracting for, I think like AT&T was like the biggest client, but they work with like hundreds of different staffing agencies. And basically we was calling all the same people. And so you need like a unique identifier because it could be 3 Nate Wileys out there. So they need to be able to keep track of, you know, who submitted this Nate Wiley for which position. Mm-hmm. And so that's why some were like last four, but some were like full social, which even to this day is crazy, especially with all the like stolen identity and stuff out there. So hopefully they figured out a new way around, you know, being able to sort of put that identifier on the person. But yeah, like I've been hung up on so many times. Back then, I was so glad. That was one of the main drivers I wanted to go in-house. I was like, I like recruiting, but this is terrible. It just felt too scammy sometimes.
Yeah, man. It's like That's why I started laughing at you talking about it, because, like, you'll know when a job is probably hiring for, like, all the same roles, because you're going to see all the same people hit your LinkedIn with the same message. And some people, I don't know, believe if they're doing it right or not, because the signature from the email has somebody else's name. So I'm just like, are you really a recruiter, or are you trying to scam people out here?
Like, what kind of – what does the – it's just a different name, or it's like a different title?
Let me – I actually show you right now, because I was like – I wasn't going to respond to it anyway, because I was like, I don't even know who this person is. Because, like, now LinkedIn try to do the thing like verify recruiter or whatever. But I'm like, I'm still not sure you're a verified recruiter. So look at his name, but then look at the rest of the email. So it's like his name on LinkedIn versus what he sent. So I'm like,
oh, yeah, this overseas too.
I'm like, bro, did you just copy and paste something from somebody else you saw online, or did you forget to change the signature?
Yeah, that's crazy.
But I pay attention to little stuff like that. I have to pay attention to, because
that's a big red flag. Even if they copy and paste that message, and that could be, I imagine, especially an agency like that, they probably, the company itself might be U.S. based, and then they contract out all the recruiters overseas because you can pay them a lot less. And I'm sure it's literally just a thing of just copy and pasting a script and just, you know, shotgunning that out to as many people as possible and just seeing what bites they get. So it could be a legit opportunity, but the operation side of it is you know, kind of trash and sort of like fly by night type of deal.
Yeah, and honestly, I really have never had no success with those type of recruiters anyway.
It depends on who you are and what you're looking for. Like, I do know some people who, like, that's kind of, you know, the way they do their career. Like, they do a lot of these short-term contracts through companies like that, and they just kind of, you know, stack them back to back. But the majority of people do avoid that. It's just like anything else, right? You get contacted about, like, you don't trust it, you don't want to really deal with it. There's probably like a big language barrier. So I think it's just a matter of where you are in your career, right? Like, if you got a solid career going and you have opportunities that you know are legit, it's like, why even entertain that kind of stuff? But there could be, you know, people out there who actually need to entertain that because they are struggling to find something. So in those cases, you know, why don't do nothing stupid, right? Like, don't fall for a, you know, African prince trying to make you rich type of scam. But, you know, like, why don't you just lump all that into, all right, this is part of my job search. Like, I'll exchange some columns with them and see how it goes. But if it comes off too scammy, you don't trust it, like, just stop. Like, it's not going to cost you anything. Right. So, you know, but I get it to be like completely dismissive.
Yeah. Back then, being a recruiter like that, how did pay work? Was it like commission based, or how did it work?
Mostly commission. Like, you, when I started, it was like a base of $35K, and then you get commissions off of whatever. It's called like your spread. So essentially, it was all contract work. So whatever your margin is, of course, like, increases your commission. So if you could work out a deal to where you could bill AT&T for $115 an hour, and then you negotiate the contract with them for $100 an hour, and then you get that $15 spread, and then you get like commission off of that every hour work. So it was cool, man. I think if you want to be a recruiter, back then, if you want to be a recruiter, it was the best way to kind of get your foot in the door. But again, like, it was very, you know, it was all literally like cold call. Like, that's when it was Monster, Career Builder. You get a rec come through, and literally, like, you just hit the boards. And anybody that had those keywords, you call them, shoot an email, call them, shoot an email. And, like, it's really, like, that's the only way. That was the only way to even operate. Like, it wasn't, like, a silver bullet to it. Like, you just had to outwork your own team members, because usually it was, like, two or three of y'all working on the same role. And then once you get, like, two or three of your best submits put in, the AE or somebody be like, all right, we got enough on that. Y'all switch to this one. And that's just – at what work was.
Yeah. And so you say, so what's the difference with the account executive versus like what you were doing? What are they managing?
So account execs basically kind of responsible for managing the relationship with the client. So usually the account exec are the ones who, depending on how senior their team was, they may have oversight over who was actually being submitted. So like when a recruiter first started, an account exec usually wouldn't give them access to like either the VMS, so the I think it's called like the vendor management system. And so the VMS is sort of like the portal between the agencies and the client. And so everybody that's working on those roles are submitting people into the VMS. And so the account exec is usually the one, as a recruiter, I would send my people to the account exec. He'll make sure they're solid and then submit them to the VMS. And the ultimate goal of the account exec was to try to get as close as possible to whoever the decision maker was at the client, which was always interesting because the client hires a VMS to put a buffer between them and the agencies, right? It's like, we don't want to hear from all these account execs. We don't want to hear from all these recruiters. You all manage that relationship and then like just make sure we're getting the best people. Basically, the job of the account exec was to find ways around the VMS and get directly to whoever was like doing the interviews, like whoever the hire manager was, to be able to say like, hey, like I got these two strong candidates. I don't even have to put them in the VMS. Like, let me just send them to you directly. So that was ultimately what the account exec does, is like, how do we fast track this money? Basically, like, we don't want it to be like a heads up competition between all these other agencies. Like, how do we make it to where like we're your preferred person and we can go directly to you?
Okay, it makes sense. I think I've talked to a couple of account execs in the past. I'm like, yeah, we worked with this company for like 15 years. We placed over like 60 people with them, and so we, you know, get preferential treatment because they know we always send a good applicant. So
that's the name of the game. Like, yeah, if you could do that. And then it was also to like expand the business. So just like with any other type of sales role, like you may be working with one to two hiring managers, and let's say you're working on 3 to 5 different roles, like how do you get access to other hiring managers that may be hiring for other positions and try to like expand your footprint at that client? And so it was just all about the dollars. And then it's always, you know, them that usually putting out any sort of fires. Their job was also to make sure recruiters are spending their time on what's going to move the fastest or what we have the best percentage of actually winning, and make sure like we're not spinning our wheels on stuff. Cause that's what a lot of it is, right? Like, you can work a couple of days on something and by the time you find two good people, it's like, oh yeah, they done close that up. Like, it's so.
But even worse, you're the recruiters like working with a company and they not even responding to the recruiter, like, hey.
Oh, that's to this day. Like, that's even in-house recruiting. Like, it's, you know, they can usually do a kickoff meeting. They tell you how important something is. Recruiter, you know, run out, try to find the best people, and then sometimes you might not even hear back, you know, for a week or so.
It's been longer than a week on some of them. I'm just like, bro, at this point, I just go apply internally. Versus with y'all, because they not telling y'all nothing and y'all like pretty much wasting time. Well, they not wasting time, but the company is wasting time by not knowing what they want.
Yeah, like it's the thing about recruiting is it's any individual within sort of the process can be the bottleneck, right? Like a recruiter could be slow to move on stuff. The hire manager might be slow to move on stuff. The candidate might be slow responding or submitting their resume or doing what they need to do or scheduling an interview. You know what I'm saying? So like really a recruiter is trying to sort of manage all that. Like, how do we keep all this moving forward in the right direction versus, you know, and I've had to learn that even now, as long as I've been recruiting, like you can't just, you know, kind of submit something and hope things work out. Hope that the candidate gonna do what they need to do. Hope that the hiring manager do what they need to do. Like, you really have to kind of keep pressing on everybody to try to figure something out. So I can't say like recruiting hasn't gotten any easier, even with all the new technology. Like, it's still, you still got to reach out to people directly and try to communicate as best as you can to try to get what you need from folks.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, now let's switch gears to go. You said you want to go in-house. What was the biggest, I guess, tech company that you worked for in-house?
Lyft. So Lyft was definitely like my, you know, whatever. I mean, we in Dallas, so like if you're an NFL player and you're trying to, you know, get your name in something big time and you get to play for the Cowboys, like that's, for me, like Lyft was like my Dallas Cowboys, right? Like that's sort of the shining point on my resume. Although I've worked with a lot of great companies, like that one was like most notable when I joined them, they was actually like number one startup on LinkedIn. So like I joined at a time when, you know, they had all this buzz recruiting. I ain't gonna say recruiting was a breeze, but like we didn't even have to source that much because so many people was applying to us. And so like we just spent most of our time in ATS, you know, trying to find the best people. We were well funded, like we was on our way to IPO. And so like if we did find the right person, comp wasn't an issue. Like they'll throw more bonus at them, more equity. And so when you got all those different sort of wheels turning in your favor, like that's when recruiting is fun. Like that was a time in my career where, you know, recruiting wasn't stressful. Like we was having fun as a team. Yeah. We was finding good people, you know.
I think everything was relaxed then too. What year was this? I mean, what years?
I joined in 2018.
Okay.
And stayed through, I think I left in 23.
Yeah, so I think, but that period between probably like 2019, 2022 was probably like the more lax hiring thing that...
Everything before COVID. Like, COVID was...
I'm saying even during COVID, you know, people was just getting hired to get hired.
It did. It was... So COVID had like some quick swings. Exactly. Like it shut down in a day. Then it turned on in the day and just like we back at it. Cause yeah, like I remember probably like 2021 to be a recruiter, like he was popping. Like when I tell you my inbox was, I mean, at least like daily, I was getting hit up by like three or four like good tech companies saying like, hey, like we hiring, we building out our team, like come join us, come be a team lead, come do all this stuff. Yeah, it was a good time to be in it because everybody was trying to like rebound from all the layoffs from COVID, and it was just like this resurgence of like capital and all these different tech companies and stuff like that, and they had laid everybody off, so they were trying to catch back up and hire everybody back, and at the sort of the goals and at the speed they wish they could hire people back just didn't balance with really a thorough interview process. And so that's why so many people was able to get into tech too, because like we really just had to do like pooled hiring, right? Like you just get as many candidates, qualify them, you know, run them through like the same process, and then like just kind of set a bar. And if anybody came in above that bar, like send them an offer. Like, and that's how quickly we was trying to hire. So it was a time. It was a time to get in.
Because you had the videos.
Easy come, easy go though. Yeah. That was the thing, because before that, we was flying everybody in before we extend offers. Like, you had to do it in person. And so once COVID hit, it's like, we're going to do everything video. And so that made everything that much more faster. I mean, it was dope. It was dope while it lasted.
Yeah. Now, you may not remember this, but I wanted to ask you, like, what's your – being an employee, what's, like, the worst either applicant, screening call, or whatever – thing that you've had to deal with as a recruiter?
I think the worst is just kind of when you get on a call, when it's actually can go two ways. Like you get on a call and then like the candidate's just kind of like an asshole, right? Like they just, and the situation you're in is, you know, this person's been an asshole because they know that they're qualified for the role. And so, like, you almost got to put up with the attitude because you do want to submit them, right? And so, like, you kind of have to play that game of, all right, like, let me not be completely dismissive to your attitude or how you doing. Like, let me try to bring things back to where, like, no, we think you'll be a good fit, and let me try to sell you on the opportunity because you already know you don't need us. And so you have to go into the mode of really, like, trying to convince them like why it's worth their time to actually go through this process, because you can't oversell it too and just be like, you don't have to actually go through these steps of interviewing. And so like for me, like those are tough for me because I don't like dealing with them, and you know they're gonna be a headache throughout the entire process. Like that's what it comes down to. Even when they get an offer, they kind of stall on responding, or they go crazy with the counter, or they like literally it'd be people like trying to change company policy around like what works for them. And when you had a larger company, startups, it isn't that bad because you can still, you can kind of make up whatever you want to do when you're just starting out at a company. If your company is less than, 30 people, what's the rule? Like, people just kind of doing what they want to do anyway. But when you get into those organizations that's like 1,000 plus, like, we have, policies, procedures, a handbook. And so when you start asking for stuff that goes against the handbook, it's like, come on, man. Like, you're doing a lot right now. So those are kind of like the worst candidates to deal with. But honestly, I don't have like a horror story to where like, oh man, like that almost broke me. Like it just be like the consistent drip of candidates that kind of just kind of wear you down. And it's like, man, I don't want to deal with this again.
Like, yeah. Deal. And what it's like what, like software engineers or
the technical folks are definitely the more difficult to deal with.
I would agree.
I think, but the pendulum always swings, right? Like, now tech folks are a lot more humble because AI is able to do a lot of this tech stuff that at one point in time was like only they could do it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, no one else was even out here trying to attempt to do what they could do. And so now, like, you or a recruiter would get hit up with a lot of people being a lot more humble around, like, hey, like, I'm looking for this, I'm open, I'm flexible, I can relocate. Like, I mean, they kind of landing all out there. But the cost and the quality of tech skills, throughout the last, I would say, like, decade, just kind of ebbs and flows, right? And so it's good for a person to understand when they're kind of at that peak of what their value is to an organization. Mm-hmm. So they're able to kind of make those demands.
Yeah. What do you think the distrust of recruiters comes from?
I mean, I think it's like any sales role. I'm the type of recruiter. I'm not as sort of empathetic as some recruiters are, which is fine. Like, I think I've gone through a couple of different phases throughout my 15 years, right? Like, it's mm-hmm. been, I want to be best friends with every candidate, and I want to, get buddy-buddy and keep them informed. And then, like, there's been times where, like, hey, we got these goals to hit as a company. I don't have time to be your best friend. Like, yeah. I have to kind of crank these calls out. I got to let people know where they stand and kind of, who's – one thing I've always learned in staffing is, like, work close to the money. So whatever candidate I feel like is going to be the likely hire, like, those are the ones you kind of are going to always gravitate towards and make sure, like, we got a texting type of situation going on because I need some quick feedback because I want to make sure that you locked in with me. But I think, like I say, like, it's the distrust comes from one. It's almost like police officers, right? Like, you don't like them until you need them. And then it's like, but I don't really mess with y'all like that. But I'm trying to get into this company. Once I get into this company, I get the offer letter. Like, I'm good to go. And so, like, I think that's where the distrust comes from. It's like, they don't interact with recruiters enough until they actively looking for a job. And then, like, they're kind of more tuned in to the different attitudes of recruiters and kind of how some recruiters can be assholes. Like, I subcontract through some folks that have larger agencies than I have, and they just need some help from time to time. And some of them, I'm like, damn, calm down, man. Like literally, like, I'll send a candidate over, and if that candidate don't look perfect on paper, or if I'm like, hey, I'm waiting on this, it's like, how long ago did you reach out to them? I'm like, I emailed them this morning. Oh, they haven't responded in 5 hours. Not worth that time. Like, it's like, damn. Like that's
might be at work.
But yeah, but that's how they think, because they just all about the sales. And like I said, if I've been in it 15 years and that guy, he's been in it like 20 plus, like, when the longer you be in it, kind of like the numb, the more numb you get to the stuff. And just like, it's like, man, I ain't got time to play around. Like, either you in or you out. And so I think that's kind of where, job seekers, if they don't have a lot of interactions with recruiters and kind of understand, like, we have a job to do, and our job is not just to be your best friend and get you placed, it's kind of like a turnoff to them. And so they just start to think, like, oh, recruiters ain't nothing. Like, we scamming. And it's like, nah, it's not a scam, but it's from our side, from our perspective, it is a numbers game. Like, it's just sort of as many applications they have to submit, like, we on the other side having to talk to that many people, and we both burned out. Like, you tired of applying, I'm tired of screening. And so, like, yeah, I think it's just sort of trying to get a mutual understanding that you're just doing the job, and it's not anything personal. Like, but, yeah, people can take them rejection letters, you know, to heart. It's like, damn, like, you mad when I reject you. You know, you mad if you don't hear from me. And it's just like, I don't know what else to tell you then. Like, I can't just give you a job, so, you know.
I just don't like being rejected on weekend nights. Like, reject me during the week.
Well, what difference does it make, though?
Don't reject me on a Sunday. You know, I'm out like, having fun with the family, whatever. Wait till Monday.
But I do get that. I get that point, but that's from that's just like all emotion. Because for me, like, sometimes I'm carving out time when I have it to go through and like clean out my applicant tracking system. But we do have the ability
to schedule. I'll just say carve it out during the week.
But we do have the ability to schedule the rejection.
Schedule the rejection to hit somebody during the week on a Monday.
So sometimes I might get off a call with somebody and know I'm not gonna move them forward. I'll schedule the rejection to send out, you know, next day or 2 days out to at least make it seem like we considered it for a little bit, whereas, like, it was really like an immediate no.
Right. Yeah, you definitely touching on some of them questions in the sense of what I showed you earlier. But before that, get into Infinite and kind of like why you started it and, I guess, mission goals, all that fun stuff that they
all about like the money, man. It's all it really is at the end of the day for me. Like, I'm just trying to, one, like, my skill set is recruiting. And so I knew that whatever I did down the road in my career had to be, you know, recruiting adjacent or something like that in some kind of way, shape, or form. The good thing about how I started out in staffing is, like, I was able to see sort of the earning potential of a company that grew, right? Like, every staffing agency started out just like Infinite, like, usually, like, just one person, like, getting clients, making placements, and then, like, you grow, you get more placements, you get more rec orders, you have to hire more recruiters, and, like, that's kind of, like, how you grow into one of these big agencies. I don't necessarily have a goal to get huge like that, and, you know, if I do start to scale and grow at that rate, like, I probably would sell it and then, like, go build a tech platform or something like that can automate a lot of this stuff. But I think I've always had the sort of the idea and the goal of starting my own thing. This was back probably like 2015, 2016. I wanted to do it, but I was like, I was a little nervous. I was like, nah, this could be like a quick crash out if I don't really have anything going, nor did I have like the bank account to support myself while I was trying to build. And so, like, I'm glad I did things the way I did, and I kind of waited because, like I said, at that point, I was working at that manufacturing company. And so I hadn't even gotten a Lyft yet. And so what I've been building since starting my own thing in 2023, honestly, just about all my clients have come through the networks I made while I was at Lyft. And so if I hadn't went to Lyft, like, I don't know, you know, I would have made something shake, but I don't feel like I would have had as many opportunities that I've had now, just because, you know, some of my current clients are the people I placed when I was at Lyft that they've left. And so now, like, they're in more leadership, you know, high level executive leadership roles, and or they've started something on their own and they need to do some hiring. And so I've always had the idea. And then what really was kind of like the, you know, what lit an additional fire under that was like when COVID hit. When I was at Lyft, we went through like 3 rounds of layoffs. And I left like maybe a month or two before they did a 4th round. And I was like, let me go and exit because I see where this headed. And so I think when I saw, for me, and I think everybody took COVID differently. You know, you had those different categories of individuals who were just kind of like, you know, that expected when things like that happened that there was going to be like the support system to kind of come in and save the day. And for me, it just was like, whew, like, hey, man, you got to have your own back out here. Like, you got to figure things out fast. And so when that hit, I really started to sort of put things together. Like, okay, like, I know I need to find a way to earn income on my own. Like, how do I make money without being on W-2? without, you know, someone extending a full, you know, permanent offer to me. And so when I kind of started to research a little bit and started to understand what are the things out there that I could do, I just kind of started piecing some things together, you know, started me a little side hustle supporting, like I did some recruiting for a nonprofit while I was still with Lyft. I did some recruiting for a construction company. And so that just kind of showed me like, okay, like I can make money. Like I kind of had two separate systems, so it wasn't no conflict of interest. Like, and I was literally like working off one laptop during the day and working off a different laptop at night, like sourcing and screening candidates and stuff like that. And so once I saw it's possible, I was like, okay, like if I can scale this, if I can ramp this up, or if I can just get some more valuable placements, right? Because, you know, recruiting for nonprofits and construction companies don't compare to, you know, recruiting for a tech startup. And so I knew like I could make 4 or 5 times as much if I got the right clients. And so I left Lyft. I went to another startup. I still stayed in-house. Thinking back, I should have just negotiated a contract with them because I only stayed there for like 6 months. But I knew I could operate a little differently at that startup. I knew it wouldn't be as much eyes on me like it would be at Lyft.
You're trying to bring the talent in.
Right, right. And
they don't
so
care about the money. They already funded.
Right. And then so what happened was that kind of gave me more of the validity as well, right? Because I held a couple of different types of positions from recruiter up into like a senior manager at Lyft, but I had never had like that head of talent, that true
title stuff.
Right, like right. And so moving to that startup, I think the title's like VP of talent or like head of talent. And so like that gave me like that last infinity stone that I needed. I was okay, now I can kind of round this out, package this up, and start pitching myself as like the startup recruiter because I have built a recruiting process with the startup. I have the big tech experience. And so like I've been able to make all these placements across all these different functions. And so I kind of took that and kind of ran with it as sort of like my proposal to startups that I do now.
Interesting. I was just thinking. Dang it, I lost it. It was gonna be. It was about what you was talking about with the recruiting stuff. But it was like it was something you just said, and I was like, dang, I'm finna ask him that. And I lost it as I started talking.
He'll come back.
Yeah. We'll get into this simply. Like, I guess when you say money, well, like generally speaking, on average, what does like a staffing recruiter make versus like an in-house recruiter at maybe like a bigger tech company, and then, you know, doing more, pretty much you're doing, I guess you're doing business to business.
Yeah. Like my Infinite, I can't lie to you. Like I'll send a contract with a proposal, however I feel like it'll make sense for that company, right? Like, you know, it might be retainer, it might be contingent, it might be a 10% fee, it might be a 15% fee. You know, it might be, you know, upfront kickoff fee plus this on the back end. It kind of, you know, I try to assess each client and figure out, one, how much budget I think they have to kind of put in recruiting efforts, and then two, you know, what's sort of going to differentiate me from, you know, another agency or another recruiter that might be, you know, pitching the same type of services. And so, you know, as long as I feel like this company can make good on the contract terms and I'm going to get some money out of it, then we'll figure it out. But when it comes to compensation, man, it really depends on the company and how much they value their recruiting team. But I think people underestimate how much money, you know, a good recruiter can make. Like, I know I see tech recruiters that easily making like $300K salary. I mean, that's doctor lawyer money. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think people really understand. Like, and to make that kind of money and you just on LinkedIn kind of having conversations with people all day, like, to me, like, that's crazy. But I've always known the value of this work because I've seen the contracts that companies, you know, have executed with agencies to be like, you know, we're gonna pay you, you know, $200,000 to make these three placements and something like that. And then me as an in-house recruiter seeing it, I was like, damn. It's like they, you know, like they not doing nothing different than what I'm doing. And so that's what's always been stuck in my head. It's like, if I can just, you know, build up the courage to jump out there on my own. Like, I can be the one sending these contracts saying, like, I'm going to find you this person and you're going to pay me this amount. And they'll pay it because I'm sitting here watching them do it. Or better yet, I'll say I'll do it for $10,000 less. And right, like, I don't have this big company, so I don't have all that overhead. So, shoot, like, I'm still going to come off, you know, coming up off of it. So that's kind of always been my mindset. And that's the practice that I still have now. It's just like, you know, like a company that'll charge you, you know, a 25% fee, I can charge you a 15% fee. And that 15%, you know, is going to hit me, you know, much better and be a lot more beneficial than a company doing 25%. They got to split that across, you know, a team, AEs, office mm-hmm. space and benefits and pay, you know what I'm saying? All that kind of stuff. It's like, I put all that in my pocket. Money. Yeah, like I can take that.
What about, so do you plan on getting any staff this year?
I don't know, man. I actually had a somebody that worked under me for contract probably like 8 months for last year. And it was dope. Like, so basically my client was saying, like, hey, we need to ramp up. Like, how much more can you take on? And really, I've always tried to, I gotta leave myself a little bit of buffer. So usually the most hours I build for a client is like maybe like 30 hours a week. Because if I ever try to make that agreement that I'm gonna work for you for 40 hours, like, that's a full-time job. So I need to be able to make sure that the expectation is, like, I'm still a consultant. Like, once I do a 40-hour contract, like, they're gonna think I work for them and I should be on for them, you know, all times of the day. Like, I need to be able, because at any point in time, if they reach out to me, if they Slack me or they email and it take me a little time to respond, I'm like, yeah, like, I work for you from these hours to these hours today. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, so I need to be able to kind of build in sort of that sort of back door where I can always go do my own thing and they know that I have other things going on. But I think I made like maybe an extra $2,000, $2,500 a month off the contract I had. So I'm paying him out of my payroll and then I'm billing the client. But I can't lie. Like, if I do that again, I need to set up my money a little bit different, just being honest. Like, that was my first go at it. And so, like, I'm paying him every 2 weeks like clockwork, whereas, like, I'm getting paid from the client, you know, they have, like,
every
a net
90 days.
Right, they have a 90. Net 30. And so, like, I'm burning through cash, like, paying him, waiting on my return. And I was like, whew, yeah. So I was like, damn, boy. I was like, it's time to pay you again? Like,
hold on now. I'm going to get it to you.
Like, dang. Well, I mean, it started out with and then I had to understand, you know, he got a family. And so, like, because I started out, I was like, hey, like, let's just see how this works. And I think I started out, like, maybe, like, 20, 25 hours a week with him. And then, like, he was pushing me every week, like, hey, man, I really need to get to 40. I really need to get to 40. Because he's always had, like, a full-time job. And so, like, he was thankful that I found him and he was getting some income. But, like I say, he had a whole family to support. So I understood. Yeah. So I went to the client basically being like, hey, like, I'm gonna work 25 hours a week max. You know, my guy wants to up his to 40. Is y'all cool with that? And then they signed off on it. And so, like, so I'm paying him, you know, an 80-hour a week paycheck out of my bank account and then got to get mine on the back end from them. And so, like, it just showed me how to manage my money better. And I was like, yeah, like, I kind of jumped into this thing. I knew it was going to be, you know, like a stress test, but, like, you don't really know until, like, you get in it. And so, like, I was able to kind of, like, once I was doing it for about 3 months, like, I started kind of being able to, when I did get paid from the client, like, set that money aside because I know this needs to be, like, my payroll fund for him. But they converted him to a full-time employee. So we've kind of switched gears, which is why I love what I do. Like, you get to be so flexible. Right. So he's the talent manager now at the startup. And I kind of support him more from a sourcing standpoint. So, like, I'm still getting my money with less responsibility because I don't have to do all the reporting. I don't have to, like, have the meetings with the founders and kind of all that kind of stuff. And so I've been able to kind of take a step back. My rate hasn't changed, so I'm still billing them, you know, my normal rate. But now I get to go out and kind of find other opportunities like that to kind of help them build up again. So it's kind of like a rinse and repeat type of business model.
Yeah.
So it's really not designed to last forever. I've actually been with that client for like 2 years now. And so this year my plan is like, all right, like how do I find a new client that I can run up my rate on? Cause now I have 2 years that I've done this, that I've scaled recruiting at another startup. Like, let me do that for you. And then this time, you know, throw a little bit more on there.
Dope, man. So one of the things I've seen that you put on your page before is you're talking about, oh yeah, we know they use AI right here. How are y'all determining who used AI?
I mean, the biggest indicator is them dashes.
Yep.
So if them dashes all throughout, then yeah, like we know they use that. I for one though, like I don't care. Like I think we should be using AI to make our life easier and simpler. The thing is, like, are you using the AI to better position yourself in a way that's truthful? Right. Like if you use an AI to just tell straight out lies, it's like, why is that beneficial to anyone? You're going to end up making yourself look stupid. Like it's just one of those things where it's like, okay, like if this resume looks great, which is why I could care less about a resume. Like I'm all about that LinkedIn. Like give me that LinkedIn. I feel like that LinkedIn is a better representation. Right. Like it's almost like checking somebody's Instagram. Like if the Instagram look a little weird, then I'm gonna have my doubts about how you actually operate in real life. And so I need your LinkedIn to be a good representation of how I feel like you come across as like a career professional, right? Like you should have some comments. Like you should have some updates. Like I should be able to kind of follow your career journey. I should see what certs you done got. Like I feel like going to LinkedIn is me being able to really tap into who you are as a professional. And so when I meet people who are just like anti-LinkedIn and I'm not putting my information on it, it's like, you're really only hurting yourself. Like you're not fighting the system or the man or whatever because you're refusing to update your LinkedIn. Like you're just making yourself less visible to people who may be really out here looking for somebody like you. But we'll never find you if you don't have some sort of like, you know, internet presence. And so like if you want to hide out and keep your head down, that's going to make it a lot harder for you to get those opportunities that I know you're going to be looking for at some point in time. And that's what a lot of people get stuck at. It's like, I got a job. I'm good. I've always had a job. I know what I'm doing. The layoffs come out of left field, knock you on your ass.
Yeah,
and now you don't know what to do. Like now you literally have no sort of strategy about how to even begin to look for a new job. And you just kind of start shooting your raggedy resume into all these applicant tracking systems, wondering why, you know, it's not going nowhere, why I'm not hearing back. When I hear people talking about they done applied to like 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, I'm like, that's your process is broken. I'm not saying that it may not take, you know, a considerate amount of applications to see a good return. But if you're submitting that many applications and you're not getting at least, you know, 10 to 15% interviews off that to where like, okay, like I'm.
I might even settle for 5 for some people, 5%.
Depending on what your skill set is. Yeah, like if you, and it's all about the market, right? Like if the skill set you have is in high demand, then yeah, you'll see an uptick in callbacks and things like that. Whereas like if you kind of like middle of the road, like you say, 5% is something that you should take a little bit of pride in, because at least you get eyes on it. People like what you got going on as far as like on paper. But again, like that's just the first step. So if AI did all your resume and you can't speak to what AI said you can do, like I said, you just kind of starting to look
a little. They mentioned it right there.
Yeah, you looking a little foolish, and then you wondering why you getting ghosted. It's like you face planted. Like it literally, like it was like, damn, like, and recruiters can usually tell like in that first 5 to 10 minutes, like, yeah, this ain't it. This ain't the one. And we kind of just give you grace for another 10 or 15 minutes because, you know, you done took the time, you done, you know, stepped away from your job or whatever, and you done put on a clean shirt and all, like, so I don't want to just completely dismiss you.
Clean shirt.
Oh man, like, cause I get it, man. When you actively looking, like it is, it's a little bit mentally taxing, right? Like you kind of You wake up every day hoping the day is the day.
No, listen, I got laid off in 2018. I was like, I would get emails and stuff like that, but by the time it would hit whatever time, I was like, I bet, man, I'm ready for the day, the new day. Because I'm like, am I getting rejected on whatever interview went on? Like, who hit me up today? Like, so now I definitely feel you. And then that's when I normally say, if you that unsuccessful in your job search, your resume trash.
It really, it's either your resume trash, you're not positioning yourself, and then you're not taking into account how challenging and sort of like how much more difficult it is to be a job seeker today, which is something I think people should just embrace. Like, listen, you can run from it, and you can, I hate when I talk to somebody and they talk about how, you know, how they used to get interviews and how things used to be. It's like, if it's not like that no more, like, you really only hurting yourself by being stuck in a time where you felt like you was at your peak, right? You really sound like somebody who washed up, talking about how, like, back in the day, you used to be able to get it in and all that kind of stuff. And
hey, you ever seen the TikToks? Like, man, I used to be a hell of an athlete.
Right. That, and that's how you sound. It's like, man, but I used to never have to look for a job. People used to come get me. Okay, well, you need to assess where you are today and kind of figure out, like, how do you increase your valuable visibility today? Because right now, clearly, it's not coming across.
So, look, funny enough, I'm one of the main podcasters that have receipts. My LinkedIn, I really could like do straight content just from what people send me on LinkedIn, like for real.
Like reaching out to you about like job opportunities?
So one young lady, she was talking about her struggles of like getting interviews and everything. But like I said, whenever people say they struggle to get interviews, I already know what it is. And it don't matter what you click on. You can click on any one of them. Now, they use AI to make it. And I always tell people, if you don't know what a good resume look like, using AI ain't going to help you that much because you don't know how to prompt.
I need to start sending more voice notes on LinkedIn. My issue is most of my communications with people on LinkedIn are...
Did they download for you?
Oh, you're talking about your resume?
Yeah, I'm going to show you.
So most of my communications on LinkedIn Recruiter, they don't have that voice feature.
Oh, okay.
They need to.
But like they just threw it in there, bro. Like, well, you got
no. This is her resume.
Yeah, they had no projects. You had some hot buzzwords in there, but they weren't being used in the work descriptions.
The first thing I point out on this, and I tell people that whenever your summary is in paragraph format, big skip. Like, I ain't about to read that. Like, like because we usually are scanning profiles. And so it needs to be in bullet format because that bullets are by design.
I used to have like I used to have like a career highlight section.
You should.
So I used to have like five bullets or six that I didn't have that was like in a job description.
I have a template. Yeah, this just isn't well formatted at all. Honestly, at this point, like I have a consulting resume that I've created now, just because sometimes, you know, I might reach out to somebody and they just ask for a resume. But I was like, I don't really have like a resume no more, right? Like my work is just structured a little bit different. But at the same time, I understand people want to see something on paper. So if this is an opportunity to get some money, I'm going to give you something. But my whole front page is almost just like a bulleted summary. And I don't know why people don't think that that's appropriate, but it's your resume isn't necessarily about, don't get me wrong, it needs to be formatted. It needs to look like you know how to put together a document, but it's more about the content. And so if those first 3, 4, 5 bullets are like you literally hit me with your best work, right? Like, boom, I got 10 plus years in this. Boom, I done completed this. Boom, I done saved the company this. Boom, I done implemented this. Like, okay, like you get my attention the more I go down. But when it starts with, you know, I'm a eager professional, you know, with a strong mindset, getting along well with others. It's like, yo, what?
Like, yeah, a lot of stuff don't make sense. And then when people use AI, their resumes tend to like a job description. So yeah. It's like the job description typically say what you may do on a day-to-day. I want to know what you did that's different from the job description. Like right. You said, those bullet points.
And you should at least be able to, at this point, understand how to leverage AI in order to say, hey, I need to format my resume based on this job description and prompt whatever you use in Claude, ChatGPT, or whoever to be like, you know, ask me the appropriate questions so that you have the detailed information to enter into my resume based on this job description. And so, like, if you do it that way, it's going to read that, okay, like, this person is responsible for XYZ, and it's going to ask you, you know, very specifically, you know, what are the examples of XYZ, and then it can structure it into a bullet that's a lot more impactful.
Yep.
Versus, you know, you just basically, because that's honestly how people used to do resumes. Like, they'll take whatever job description they got hired against and just drop that onto their resume to be like, I do this. I mean, because it seems like the easiest way to go about doing it, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, even to this day, most people struggle with telling you what they do on a day-to-day basis, right? Like, we just kind of like in autopilot. Like, we log on and we just get to work. But if someone was to ask you, like, what do you actually do? It's like, you know, like, you kind of can't really, like, contextualize, what is it do I really do? And so that's why I try to tell people, like, you should have a thorough understanding of not only what you do, but why does the business need you? You know what I'm saying? Mm. Like, what are you actually contributing on a day-to-day basis, or weekly or monthly or quarterly? Like, sometimes you kind of need to start at a high level and then kind of drill down into what it is that you actually
do. That goes into other things, too. When I'm doing resumes, I'm like, all right, hey, send me all your accomplishments, things you did. A lot of times people don't have any.
They don't even think about it. They literally don't even think about it. And yeah, if just think about, like, if you're going through an entire year of working for a company, you should be able to look back on that year and be like, you know, like, what did I really do here? I don't care what your role is. Like, if they paying you to do a job, I don't care if you the trash man. You should be able to be like, shit, like, I disposed of trash of millions of homes.
I'll be like, perfect
in the zip code. Like,
perfect attendance, the cleanest truck, some.
Right. Like, trash man of the year because, you know, I optimize my route efficiency. Like, something. Like, you kind of got to be able to understand, like, all right, clearly I'm doing something right. Like, I'm still here. Especially when it comes to, like, performance review time, like, you should honestly be leading your performance review. And that's something that comes with time and kind of confidence. But it got to a point, like, I used to start to challenge my manager. Like, if they try to say, you know, I've never gotten, like, a less than meets, but I'm gonna bring receipts and be like, nah, actually, I think I exceeded, because,
you know, it's hard for them to get exceeded.
Right, because it's like, if this is meets and I did this and this, you can't tell me, you know, it's kind of hard for you to kind of grade me at a B when I know I done came with A working. But you got to be able to bring those receipts, and you got to be able to get to a point to where you can kind of brag on yourself and talk about your accomplishments throughout the year, because they not thinking about you. They really not thinking about you in that way up until it's time to do the performance review. Everybody's performance reviews, they usually wait to the last minute. They usually up late or wake up early in the morning, like, trying to submit it by the deadline. And then they'll usually give you an extension, all that kind of stuff. But that just all goes to show me, like, ain't no one is sort of prioritizing talking about honoree. You know what I'm saying? Like, that ain't why I come to work. Like, it ain't to lift you up on a pedestal. And so you got to lift yourself up and be able to tell people, like, okay, this is why I'm killing it. That helps them out. And they usually not going to push back on you. Like, shit, if you done did the work for me, I'm just going to sign off on it. Like, yeah, you exceeded. So yeah,
you got to hit that TO. I love me some me.
Right. You got to.
Now, if you don't, all right, so here's this some finesse game. If you didn't do nothing, go see the people who did do something, write it down, learn about what they did, inquire about it, and now that's something that you did. If you could talk to it on the interview, they might believe.
Oh, yeah, like, there have been times in interviews, you know, they might ask me about an accomplishment or a challenge or something like that. Like, half of it might have been true. And then, like, the back half of it might have been what would have happened. Uh-huh. Like, you know, like, if they asked me about a time that I, you know, improved a process or something like that, like, I literally might tell them about, you know, I might be in the middle of this implementation or in this improvement, but I'm going to give them my expected result. Like what I know or what I believe that what's going to come out on the other side of this. But one of the worst things you can do, and I was actually talking to one of my clients yesterday, the reason she failed to pass this lady through is because she asked her a question and the lady was just like, I don't know, and didn't give any sort of resolution as to like, I don't know, or this is what I've done that's comparable, or this is how I would go about doing
that. What was that, the like, question?
It was more so, it was a director of sales position, and so she was asking her about, like, does she have, like, a network that she can kind of come in and leverage to start to pitch the product to, and the lady, the founder, my client, like, has very specific clients that she wants to try to pitch her product to. And so she has been asking candidates, like, do you have connections with these clients in these networks? And so... she asked him, like,
say yeah.
I don't think she should have said yeah, because the lady was going to drill down even further, and she was going to hit a wall at some point. But the expectation from her was like, no, I don't have, you know, direct connections with these people, but I do know these people. These people know these people, and so I feel very strongly if I'm able to like make connections with these individuals, then I can get you know, introduced or connected to these individuals. She could have said something like, no, I don't have direct connections with them, but I know these folks always go to these big conferences. I frequent these conferences. I can prioritize getting meetings in person with these individuals. Like, there are ways I felt like, and honestly, it wasn't necessarily a gotcha question. Of course, like, it would have been great if the lady would have been able to say, like, yes, I do have connections, but it was more so like, how do you think? Like, how are you going to, if I'm telling you this is what the role entails, that I want you to get my product in, you know, with these individual companies, I want you to go ahead and start thinking through how you're going to do that, right? Like, how have you built your previous connections, right? Like, she could have easily pivoted into, like, no, I don't know those individuals, but the people I'm working most closely with now, I didn't know them up until 6 months ago, and this is how I went about building those relationships. And so you can't just say no, or I don't have that experience, or I don't know the answer, and then not offer some sort of solution, or at least know how to ask questions in order to keep it going. Like, so, like,
because at work, a lot of times it's something new that's presented us that we don't know how to do.
That's what work is. Work is just consistently solving problems. Like, if you're not doing that, then you honestly should start to get a little bit concerned, because if the problems you are getting paid to solve are no longer problems for that organization, then you start to look at like, well, we don't really need this person anymore. Like, we've kind of solved that, and or they've started to automate whatever it was that you was doing. And so that's something that people need to be mindful of, especially in the world of layoffs. Like, if you're not still actively solving problems for the company, yeah, you probably gonna be on that list, because you're not critical. Like, if you're just kind of treading water at this point. Like, you're just kind of
doing enough not to get fired.
Right. Like, you maintaining the status quo. Like, you might be helping out one person in some way, shape, or form. But if you're not on that list of people that are like, okay, like, who are our company pillars, right? Like, who do we need to actually keep our company going and running and kind of keep the lights on, versus these people that, you know what, we really don't need that team no more. Once you find yourself in that boat, you need to either switch teams, create a problem, and sell yourself as a solution, or you need to kind of start looking
externally. Remember in them shows, somebody I was watching Top Boy, and so the problem was he created a problem for one of the distributors, and he was able to solve it by usurping him, getting to his distro, and then getting the guy out of jail. He put him in jail. So it was like, it's funny. It's just funny how, like, what people do and how you can learn different things.
Oh, that's the way to – I used to I kind of took a step out of the corporate world, one, because I wanted to kind of, you know, build my own thing. But I was pretty good at the corporate politics game. Like, I was
Yeah.
I used to feel like
I know you came in there with your white button down Oxford with some chinos and brown shoes.
That used to be my part of my strategy. Like I was every office environment I ever been in, I was always voted like best dressed. Like it was just like because I'm a big black dude. So like, yeah. You know, what is something I can do that's kind of gonna make me stand apart? And like coming in, I'm a recruiter walking in a full suit. It's like who's this guy? You know what I'm saying? Like they literally people used to like, what do you do here? I'm like, oh, I'm on the recruiting team. Uh-huh. They thought I was some exec. Like, nah, I can dress nice. Like I don't have to, you know, come in with a t-shirt on just because I'm on the recruiting team.
Yeah, no, for sure. Between that and between being well dressed, coming into office and being married, that's like probably a triple threat right there of like moving up in corporate.
Yeah, you gotta and that's sometimes what it's all about. It's really building just the perception of like I'm a high performer or like I'm playing ball to your point. Like, yeah, like if you're going to be perceived almost like in politics, right? Like what does somebody do when they want to get into politics? Like I need to be married. I need to have a family. Like
a good image.
Right. Don't too many people want to vote for somebody who's like, oh, you got to run around wild. Like you, cause they think that if you have a family, that's gonna rein you in. Like you got to make good decisions.
Like, yeah, you're gonna like you was talking about the guy earlier with the family and stuff. You had to pay and all that other stuff.
Right.
It's like, hey, this
it's
person,
control. It's control.
They,
like it's like
they're gonna do their job.
They're gonna do their job. They're not gonna do nothing crazy. Just think like if you're a bachelor and you getting paid a good bit of money, like you a ticking time bomb. You know what I'm saying? Like
think about that stuff all the time.
One wrong thing piss you off. It's like, man, I don't need this. Like, I got enough money for the rest of the year. Like, versus you got a wife and two kids. Like, you just ain't gonna up and quit your job on a whim.
Because I'm like, look, I could thug it out. I was like, I thought about plenty of times. I said, hey, I was like, stuff hit the fan. Shoot, I got a membership at Anytime Fitness. Work out there, shower. Put a blow up here right there. I could thug it out if I had to.
But that's
kids and them not so much.
Literally though, that's how a man will think. Like a man, like nah, I'm gonna figure it out. You'll never know I'm down. Like as long as I keep a couple of nice outfits, mm-hmm. like you say, and I got somewhere to bathe. Like I'm gonna keep interviewing.
Get you a small storage unit, get your stuff dry clean. Put it in there.
I can go into the coffee shop and get Wi-Fi. Like I mean, most guys have you know whether it was just for fun or not have thought about like yeah if it all crumbles, like, you know, how am I going
to
build myself up?
I wonder women think about that. I know this ain't to be sexist, but, like, I always think about, like, if the worst, what would I do? I know what I would do.
Well, women got other options, though. If a woman can be pretty, like, you can find somebody to take care of you. Mm-hmm. Like, men, that's not an option. Like, we know we're not going to be cared for.
That's the whole thing. I forgot I was having that argument with my girl one time, but we was talking about that. I was telling her the difference between raising girls and boys of, like, how, like, me, like, she probably feel like I'd be, like, real tough on my younger brothers. But I'm like, ain't nobody finna come save them.
No.
I'm like, they got to, like, it don't, handsome privilege probably get you laid, but it don't really get you paid. Like, it don't take you as far as pretty privilege do.
You might find yourself be able to, you know, get off the street for a couple of nights. Like, if a girl like you a little bit. But that's only going
to
go so far.
You may be able to find you a rich woman who husband travels frequently and or whatever. But for the most part.
Now that's crazy.
That's man. Not. But that's not. You know, because you see all type of stuff. You are retail, all these other type of jobs. You see all type of stuff. But that ain't going to take you far, especially in those careers. It's only going to. It got a shelf life.
Right. Like, that's only. Whereas women are usually. That's why, I mean, if a woman has, like, a successful career and all that kind of stuff, like, and they look good, like, I've posted that before. Like, if you pretty, you smart, and you kind of got, like, street smarts, like, that's a cheat code. Like, for real, because you operating, you know, from every angle at that mm-hmm. point. Whereas it's a lot of women are raised to be a princess, right? Like, and right. So, like, that's why, I've never been the type of guy, like, oh, like, she think she should get the world just because she's pretty. Like, I think that was her strategy. Like, I think that was, you know, like, that was her goal from the beginning is to try to attract, you know, the rich guy and kind of be taken care of. And so, like, if that's your strategy, I can't get mad at that. But if you don't have, you know, those sort of assets and characteristics, then, yeah, you better get smart. You better figure something else out.
Yeah, yeah. Man, I'm going to get to, like, two of these questions.
All right.
Because I know... pretty much approaching time and my stuff is actually downstairs, so I go get. But I think one of the best ones, I think that would be useful for people, because we touched on this like years ago, but I figured it would come up in these questions, is how do you actually pull candidates in ATS? Are there defined tiers, like strong match versus good match? And in practice, do recruiters usually prioritize the strong match tier, even if someone in the lower tier may be equally qualified? I really don't know how to answer the second part of that, because it says...
Yeah, that's not equal.
Yeah, like how would you be in the lower tier, but you're equally qualified? I don't know.
Yeah, if the way I interpret that question is, like, if I have a strong match, and then someone isn't a strong match, do I consider them to be equal? Like, no. Like, they, if they wasn't a strong match. But I get the premise of the entire question. So, again, I always go back to value, right? And so I think it's important to understand, one, what's your individual value as it stands in today's market? And then you can also drill down into, like, what do you feel like the value of that skill set is at the company that you're applying to, right? So, you know, just a short sort of a short way to kind of explain what I mean is, you could be, let's say you're an accountant. You could be an accountant applying to a company that has a team of 50 accountants because they have that much revenue and that much work to do. Or you could be applying to a company where you will be the accountant, sort of responsible for setting up the entire accounting function. So those two individuals, like, you might be a strong match for that 50 accountant company, but you may be a weak match for the one that's like, no, like, you're going to be responsible for, you know, all of our accounting functions at the entire organization. And so it's kind of hard to answer that person's question, because, like, my strong fit is going to be based on the individual needs for this particular role. So your strong fit for me might be, you know, meets, you know, just a good fit. You're right, at another application. So, like, so you can't compare every application sort of apples to apples, because you have to understand, like, what it is that they're actually looking for. But I mean, the best way to go through an applicant tracking system, like, if I'm usually not going to look at no more than like 50 at a time in a session, because after that, like, your eyes start to cross, everything kind of starts to look the same. And so usually recruiters are going to try to keep it like under that 50, flipping through to kind of see who's a good match. But a lot of applicant tracking systems now do have AI built into them. Because I remember, I think the last time I talked to you, I was like, there's no such thing as beating the system. That's wrong now. Like, you do have to kind of be a lot more strategic, because now I can go in there and either ask AI to filter by certain keywords or certain experience, or the newer ones, if you pan for all the bells and whistles, I can come in, log on, and it tells me, hey, here's the top 10 applicants, you know, that came in. I can put in filters, right? Like, show me the best fits that have applied within, you know, the last 3 days, and it may give me 25. And so, like, I'm only going to look at those 25. And so that's how, you know, recruiting has changed, just from like a technology standpoint, to whereas I used to have to flip through everyone, whereas now, like, I can start by filtering out the people that I feel like aren't a good fit, and I can only focus on the people that are at least matching those buzzwords on their resume. And from there, I start to understand, you know, who's made more impact, you know, who has been able to clearly sort of articulate on their resume how they're a strong fit, versus the people who, as we mentioned earlier, kind of submitted a resume that's just based off of a job description. It was just kind of telling me what their scope is and kind of what they do at a high level, versus telling me what they've done to actually drive some sort of impact.
No, that's facts. I think and one good conversation that I want to have on live one day, because eventually, outside of this, I'm going to like go like back to like some type of panel style where it's just be like a free fall, whatever, with different topics. Is a friend of mine, we were talking about how years of experience really should not be the barometer anymore, because some people at one time, those years of experience they had, they were competent, but you may find a guy, maybe this is kind of what that person's talking about, you may find a person, they don't have the 5 years, but they got two. But if you was to put them head to head with this person, let them compete or figure whatever out, the 2-year experience person would be better. And so I think a lot of people are getting discounted now because they just don't meet the maximum or with minimum qualifications, but they may be a better fit because they still are in that stage where they are hungry and getting better. Whereas a lot of people I know from, like, when I start working with them now, like, yeah, your better days probably passed and you kind of just existed now. So, yeah, you might have been doing it for 20 years, but your experience right now is showing about 3 to 4.
No, that's actually a great point. And I agree. I'm aligned. I think that's a hard sell just because we do sort of I think just on a very simple level of the way people think, right? Like if someone just got their license and someone been driving for 10 years, who you gonna think is a better driver?
The one that's been driving longer.
Right. And I think that's just the way even now, especially let's just call them companies. That's the way companies think, yeah. Right? Like if we're looking for, like, I'm working on some roles now and, you know, the leader is just sold on the fact, like, yeah, this person needs to have at least, you know, 10 to 15 years of experience in order to qualify. You know, if I find someone, let's say someone has 7, those 7 are very strong, like, I'm going to have to take the extra step, right? Like, I'm going to have to talk to that person and really drill in on what they've done and be able to, you know, finesse it in a way to be like, hey, like, I know this person is potentially 8 years shy of what you're looking for, but
they've done everything as long.
Right. They came in the game strong, right? Like, they, you know, they work for top companies. They may have, you know, a specialty degree or something like that. So I'm going to have to, like, really, you know, put a lot of icing on that cake in order for them to even start to think that this person meets the qualifications. And so I, you know, it's tough. My advice to someone like that is, like, I hate to say it, but you have to find the company that is going to be a little bit more open-minded, right? Like, I think candidates, job seekers, people in general spend too much time trying to force their way into situations that don't want them. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just sort of like you can't sit there and try to make that case for, like, yeah, like, I know I only have 7 years of experience and the job description says 10 to 15. Like, you might just need to keep looking, right? Submit your resume, but, like, don't harp on it. Right, like, don't try to beat that drum so hard to be like, I know I can do it, I know. Like, you might not even get looked at, right? Whereas it's another company out there that they may not have a years of experience, right? Like, and there are, especially startups. Sometimes startups will create a job description that say, we don't care what kind of education you got. We don't care how many years you've been doing this. Like, we're looking for the right person. Like, we're looking for somebody who can come in and solve these big problems. And so that's the job for you. Like, that's how you actually build your career, by finding those companies that are, you know, well aligned with what it is that you feel like, you know, you embody, that you feel like you can punch above your weight, versus going to these traditional companies that just have it very clearly laid out. Hey, this is what qualification means to us, right? Yeah. Like, go do something else and then circle back if you want to go to
the
company.
I think so it's bad. That. I think the frustration sometimes is, like, I've had times where, like, I knew, like, I pretty much was a strong match, but the person might have had just recent leadership experience or whatever. But sometimes they probably wasn't even leading good or leading at a good team. Like, sometimes I think a lot of companies don't take enough chances on probably, like, somebody that may not be the desired fit, and I think they mess up like that. Because in the past day, I had, like, two or three companies that's reached out that started hiring processes that I talked to them, like, last year. I'm like, oh, y'all messed up and y'all didn't know who y'all hired. Well, one instance, I was working with a recruiter that was like a firm, and the client, they were dragging their feet on it, and they ended up putting a role on hold, and then got, I guess, an internal referral. I'm like, y'all already knew y'all didn't have the talent internally, or y'all would have never hired these people to look for y'all. Why did you even waste people's time like that, to the point that they actually are looking again for that same role? And then the same thing happened for this other role. I'm just like, are y'all just putting stuff on hold? Y'all run out of budget? I'm like, what are y'all doing? Because the other red flag to me is, years ago, Ernst & Young's had the same role over and over again open. Like, I interviewed for it back in, like, 2019 or something like that, and I didn't get it. But I would always see the role keep on being posted. I'm like, yeah, that's a revolving door, and they don't know what they want.
What was it, a role that's – because sometimes we have positions that we'll post like an evergreen position. And so essentially it's something that we know we're always going to be looking for. And so it's just a matter of like really just building a pipeline of people so that, you know, if we get resignations or if we need to like terminate someone, like we don't have to start from scratch with that search.
I don't think it was. I think at that time, I think their program wasn't that good.
I mean, that very well could be. I mean, it's a lot.
Because a lot of companies, they go off the allure of their namesake versus trying to get actually like make stuff right. So it's like, they pretty decent. They should have been more far along. But like at the time when I got like Goldman Sachs, like they, you know that people want to work for them. Mm-hmm. So they were still behind on some stuff that they should already had done. But I mean, all in all, it's not like they had no major breaches or anything like that. There are other companies that did that shouldn't have. It's like you make all this money, pay a little bit more, so you ain't got to shell out this, you know, $100 billion or whatever you did for this breach. Like Change Healthcare had to do, I think, that billion or something that they lost with the breach. But so I was like, y'all just know that y'all got a monopoly and legacy, and people know you've been here for so long, that's why y'all can operate this way.
Yeah. I mean, it's that's probably going to, you know, even now, like, I don't know, like, I haven't looked at them in a while, but so stuff like that only lasts for so long, right? Mm-hmm. Just like when I told you I started working at Lyft, you know, recruiting was, like I said, it wasn't a breeze, but we didn't have to work hard. Like, it was just kind of like, of course, like, all we got to do is post and find the sharpest needle in a stack of needles. And so post-COVID, when, you know, nobody wanted to take rideshare and all that kind of stuff, like, it got a lot harder, right? Yeah. People were like, why would I go to Lyft? Like, you know, y'all lost 75% of y'all business or whatever. And so recruiting got a lot tougher. Like, we had to really convince people of, you know, what was our recovery plan and, you know, why are we hiring when, you know, things are on a downturn or whatever the case may be. And so no one, in my experience, no one has really figured out hiring yet. And like I say, it goes back to people are so fickle that it's just got.
Should it be more assessment based, maybe?
You would think so, but you got to think about how many weirdos can complete can do well on an assessment, right? Like I literally had a situation, you know, about a couple of months ago where it was a graphic designer, and this dude, his work was sharp. Like the team loved what he could do, but he was going to be an issue. And I knew he was going to be an issue by the way we communicated, just in trying to set up the interviews and stuff like that. Like, he was just like a lot. And that's what it comes down to, whereas like sometimes people don't understand. Someone can believe that you can do a good job and still not hire you because it's like, I don't want to put up with that. Like, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah. And did he check off like, did they have like mental problems maybe?
I don't think he had mental. I mean, it was just one of those things where, and I know recruiters have a very unique perspective because we do talk to so many people. Just think about the people that you've worked with that come across like a little weird, right? Like, they made it through despite of. So if we end up like not hiring someone because of behavior, and it's not always weird. Like, sometimes it's, like I say, an asshole. Like, sometimes it's just kind of, you know, the person just doesn't seem to be coming across as very truthful. Like, it's just, like, the more you do this job, the more you can pick up on little things like, like, let me double down on this real quick because I'm getting, you know, it's almost like your spidey sense start tingling a little bit. Like, I don't like the way this is operating. And then, like, sometimes that person gets through for whatever reason, whether they were able to convince the right person that they're going to be a good fit. And then I'm usually never surprised when I either hear from HR or and I'm not talking about officially. Like, sometimes it's just because I know the HR people and, you know, we may just be chit-chatting or gossiping and they be like, yeah, so-and-so, so-and-so, this going on, or, you know, working on this investigation. And they were like, I can't tell you who it is or something like that. And I'm like, I already know. It's just like, I know. Like, it's just, I'm not surprised. And then I remember at one point I worked in an office where literally I had sort of eyesight of like the glass room that they took people in when they laid them off. I was like, every time somebody go in there, I'm like,
Remind me of Insecure when that girl to go in there. Real quick before we wrap up, and I meant to ask you about this earlier, but why are applicants leaning on AI so much? And I'm not even talking about the resume part. Now I'm talking about you got these people advertising these freaking AI tools that's supposed to help them like in interviews.
AI apply and all that kind
of
stuff.
Well, not the AI apply, but you know, you have the people that use the thing that's on their screen where people are asking questions, so it's transcribing it for them so they can answer the questions. And the people not realizing, like, hey, we know you use an AI because humans don't talk like this and answer questions like this. And we're asking you questions that you really can't answer with AI. And so now between them having to make sure you turn your camera on and know you're a real person and not use a deep fake and be somebody from North Korea, like, it's a lot going on, dude. Canada's not knowing they making it worse for them and everybody else coming after them.
I mean, I think the canon is that it's just like a scammer, right? Like the person that's operating like that don't care. Like, it's a volume game. So they just figure, you know, if I run this fake play on as many companies as possible, like, I'm gonna get somebody. Like, that's I think that's their mindset. Now, that is like the actual job scammer. Like, yeah. Now if you're talking about like just a candidate that feel like I need a little extra assistance and I'm gonna use this AI tool to kind of like give me responses, I think that could be beneficial if you practice how to use it. I think the issue is, like, if you're reading verbatim, like you say, like, AI usually doesn't spit out something that talks the way you talk. And then, like, you can easily pick up on, like, I'm sure I use AI every day for my emails. It's baked into, you know, my email tool. And I'm sure my candidates or whoever I'm working with can know, like, when, you know, yeah, I just kind of told it to draft me something in response to this versus me actually coming across and saying something myself. That's not important because, like, I'm just trying to get the information across, right? Like, I'm just trying to inform you or something. Versus, you got to think about an interview process is you're actually trying to convince somebody that you know these things.
And yeah, so, that's, like, that's the right, whole issue.
And so, like, if you're just reading that verbatim, it's just like, I already don't trust you. Like, you don't look like you know what you're talking about. And you might. You might know, you might be smart. And so, like, you're actually using a tool that you don't even need instead of, why don't you just prep before you actually come and use AI to just kind of give you kind of like a baseline of topics versus, like, trying to respond in real time. To me, like, that's crazy. I just don't see how that can actually come across. That's like you ask me a question and I'd be like, so what, you know what I'm saying? It's just like,
yeah,
that's
just, how it was.
It's
said,
not natural.
I got a past client. I had referred some people to this role and he was telling me, like, why the role wasn't closed yet and, like, what, like, they couldn't find nobody. He was like, man, the interviewers told us that they were interviewing people for this role because this role was like pretty much an IC lead. So pretty much a person on that shift would be the lead. Mm-hmm. He said these people couldn't answer basic questions, but yet they had the perfect resume. And they couldn't even think through different things. So it's like,
yeah, I do for you.
So that's the thing. It's like, I'm like, I tell everybody, hey, I mean, you can try to oversee yourself if you want to, but it's going to backfire on you. I can understand why they want to, because it's a role, it's a very attractive role from the pay and the company, and it'll be cool. But you better off just being you and messing up versus.
Me myself personally, I have a fear that it's not imposter syndrome. I don't believe in that, but I have a fear of, to your point, like I don't ever want to put myself in a situation where I lied to get there and then now, like, I get found out as a fraud. Like, that's my fear.
That happens.
Like even if I run the scam and I get hired and then, like, I'm constantly, you know, having to have one-on-ones with people because it's like, hey, like, you know, you missed this deadline, like, this work was shoddy. You know, you didn't respond to this. And, like, I'm just looking like a complete failure because I misrepresented myself to get in. Like, to me, it's just like, damn. Like, I that would be hard for me to bounce back from. It's just, I'd rather,
yeah,
you know, like, I'd rather be who I am, and they just tell me, like, you're not quite, you know, what we're looking for. We need
you're not that guy, pal.
Right. Like, because then I know I can go work on it and get better. But to kind of, and I'm not even talking about embellishing. I'm talking about, like, a complete fabrication of who I am to get in the door. Like, you're going to get found out, especially if they're excited about it and they think that if you're getting hired to do something that nobody else in the company knows how to do and all that is on your shoulders.
But the crazy thing,
you're going to crash and burn.
But that's why the crazy thing is like, how did you fool the interviewers to get picked for this role? So that's the part of the hiring process thing, whatever. Like I said, recently some of the roles I've had to do, they've had me do like take home assignments or whatever. Stuff I could have clearly, well, some of it I really couldn't clearly just cheat on. Like,
some people interview very well though. I can't say that. And I think that's the part that's broken in hiring. I feel like there are great candidates that don't get hired because they don't know how to interview. And then there are, you know, poor and mediocre candidates.
Listen,
that get hired because they interview very well.
We know this to be true just growing up with the homies or whatever. You got your homie that's a good guy, but he can't really get the chick because he just don't have a good mouthpiece. And you got the dude who pretty much ain't worth nothing, but he got a mouthpiece and he can get them all.
Right. Because he carry himself different. Like, he just got the confidence and he shoot the shots. And that's the thing. Like, if you shoot enough shots, like, you
one gonna go in.
Yeah, one gonna go in. And then also, like, missing them don't mean nothing to you no more. You know what I'm saying? Versus the person who, like, oh yeah, like, I tried, I failed, I'm never gonna try again. Like, you gonna live in constant fear. And so that's what I say. It's plenty of, and that's what recruiters try to figure out on those first, you know, first or second call or however we're interacting with them. Because, you know, and that's the point of the interview process. And as much as I have, you know, my complaints about interviews and how they're ran, I do understand the point, because if you hire someone that you feel like you've solved the problem, right? Like, okay, like, we needed this person, we hired this person, and you thinking I can move on to the next thing. And not only does this person not fix the problem, they themselves become a problem. So now you have two problems. Like, that's honestly where a lot of issues come from with people, you know, not trusting companies and recruiters and stuff like that, is because literally they're operating because they've been burned before. And this is going to impact them in a way that they don't want to, you know, they don't want to have to live with. And that's also why some interview processes take so long, because they're scared to make a decision. So they literally, like, they try to share the blame. So they have you meet with all these people so that if you do get hired, one person can't be blamed for, you know, that hiring decision. Like, they spoke with five different people and we all said yes. And sometimes it's that simple. It's just sharing the blame. But I've seen people get hired and it go left real fast. Like, as soon as they sign that offer letter, they become a problem. And it's just like, and then you start to look at their behaviors and how they operate, and you can tell, like, you done did this before. Like, you run like this how you operate. Like, you've done this before. That, and then it starts to make sense why, you know, they did 8 months with this company, a year and 2 months with this company, 4 months with this company. You know, like, you start seeing, like, yeah, like, you a problem. Like, you a consistent problem. And you've gotten good at interviewing, and you probably lied about why you separated from those companies and stuff like that. But your skill set, your experience, your knowledge, and the way you come across, and you probably have some element of attractiveness. Like, all these things go into play, right? Like, people want to believe that you are as good as you say you are. Like, we really do. And so, like, if you're able to kind of put all that together into a nice formula and sell it to somebody, you'll keep getting job offers. You'll keep fooling the next person. And I think some people have made that their career, right? Versus actually trying to learn the actual skill. Like, they've created the skill of, like, oh, I'll get hired. I'll get a job. And I know how to stretch it out for at least like 6 to 8 months. I'll stir up some shit and I'll sue them. It's literally people out here who do that. Like, they've had like multiple lawsuits with like every company they've gone to, because they'll start to claim that some sort of discrimination, or, you know, they didn't get the proper training, or, you know, their boss was trying to bully them. And And then, like, I'll know the people that they're accusing of doing these things and be like, nah, that person ain't like that. Like, yeah, they running the play. But yeah, like it's, and, but that's why people are so hesitant to pull the trigger on those hires sometimes, because as bad as something may be without that person at the company, it can be worse if you hire the wrong person. So I do get it.
Nah, facts, man. So like we ran out of time, but two things. First and foremost, how can the listeners keep in contact with you?
LinkedIn all day, man. That's where I'm at. So Nate Wiley on LinkedIn. If you want to follow me on Instagram, it's Career Hacker Nate. Those are usually the only two I mainly use. So LinkedIn is probably the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay.
If they want to email me directly, I don't know what they want to talk about, but it's nate@infinitetalent.com. If you got a question or if you just want to connect more personably than LinkedIn.
Yeah, and you spell Wiley, W-Y-L-I-E?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Well, guys, we're going to bring Nate probably for, I think I need to get him for a live episode, like a live stream where we could bring people on, kind of like a quote-unquote consultation, because we had a lot of questions I couldn't get to. And I think it really is about to start heating up, because we had some stuff that just brought up towards the end that we could have really went in on. But appreciate you for pulling up today, man.
Thank you, brother.
It's been a great conversation. And like I always say, let's stay textual and we out. Peace.
It's out.
Man, the crazy thing is I thought I was recording this into my stream yard the whole time. I wasn't. However, I knew I was already recording it.